自从俄罗斯总统普京突然对乌克兰发动军事行动以来，各国官员和情报机构都高度关注普京的野蛮行为和心理状态。美国国会议长南希·佩洛西对记者说：“有人说他得了癌症，有人说他得了新冠脑雾，其他人则认为他是一个彻头彻尾的恶霸。那普京如此残暴和非理性的决定，是他疯了，还是这位前克格勃间谍大师的精心布置？”面对无情的独裁者，要如何通过政治心理学来反制普京？普京在乌克兰遇到了出乎意料的有力抵抗，会对习近平支持俄罗斯的立场起到什么威慑作用？今天我们邀请政治心理学专家肯尼斯·德克莱瓦来分析和点评。德克莱瓦博士现任乔治·布什美中关系基金会高级研究员，为美国政策和国家安全机构分析外国领导人的能力和心理状态。Dr. Declives, thank you so much for being here.
It's nice to be on your show. Thank you very much for hosting me on Voice of America.
Thank you. From 2002 to 2016, you served as a physician slash psychiatrist with the Department of State, including at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. You have extensive research on world leaders. How would you describe Putin as a leader?
The Putin that we're seeing today is sadly the same Putin that we've seen all along, since he first came to power as the president of Russia in 2000. So he's been ruling Russia for 22 years. He is a highly intelligent, sophisticated, tactical, and I would add strategic leader, but is also ruthless. And as we've seen, especially in the last several weeks since the start of the war in the Ukraine, brutal. And many have called him a war criminal already, including the President of the United States, President Biden, and Secretary of State Tony Blinken. I prefer not to use such terms because those are legal terms, and I don't think name-calling per se is helpful in understanding even our most adversarial leaders, who you may, one of the goals is to try to bring them away from the war into a negotiating posture where this tragic war can be resolved peacefully without further loss of life.
So there's debate going on whether Putin's mad or just bad. Do you believe Putin is mad or clinically insane?
No, not at all. And there's no evidence for that. There certainly have been, because he made a huge strategic miscalculation in starting this war, it can be called a massive intelligence failure. And this coming on top of previous if to, previous aggressive actions on his part, where he's had nothing but successes. If you think of Grozny in the early 2000s, Georgia in 2008, taking the invasion of the Ukraine in 2012, seizure of Crimea and much of the Donbas region, and the support for Syria from 2015 onwards, including military support and bombings, which many there have also called war crimes, plus the attempted assassination of Sergei Skripal in England in 2018 using a banned chemical weapon, Novichok, and the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko in London in 2006 using a banned nuclear substance, polonium-210, and the attempted assassination of Alexei Navalny in 2020, again with Novichok. We've seen a pattern of aggressive behavior that Vladimir Putin has got away with. But he made a strategic miscalculation here. He underestimated the will of the Ukrainian people to fight. He underestimated President Zelensky. I think we all did. I think he's risen to the occasion and shown himself to be a remarkably courageous and heroic leader, a Churchillian type figure, at a time in the last several years because of the pandemic where the world has seen really a dearth of leadership of that caliber. And he underestimated President Biden. He underestimated the other Western leaders. And he underestimated, I think, America and Europe's resolve to counter this brutal, brutal war of aggression against the Ukraine.
So you don't believe he's mad. He's just a risk taker on bad intel. But right now he's
correct. That's correct. That's correct, Audrey. There's just no evidence that this is due to a medical or psychiatric or even psychological condition. While those theories have certainly been put out there in the last few weeks, it's a kind of false logic, which it says if someone made a bad decision, then they must be crazy. Well, we know from normal everyday life, this is complete nonsense. That many people who are quite normal make bad decisions. We know in governments, many experts can make bad decisions. And I think that's what happened with President Putin, is he made a very bad, fateful decision for himself and for Russia. And he may have also been, he may have received poor intelligence, which made it more likely in this kind of narrow insular circle of Kremlin groupthink to make bad decisions. But as you and your listeners know from even America's history, America's at times, experts have made poor decisions in foreign policy that were very difficult to undo and led to many, many years of war and other complications.
Right now, he's deliberately bombing civilian targets in Kyiv and terrifying people and other countries. So, war crime, war criminal is a legal term, but he's committing a horrific war crime. Do you think he's somewhat unhinged, or as a former KGB spy master, is he being manipulative?
I'm glad you brought up the phrase former KGB officer, and I like your use of the term spy master, because he actually ran the FSB for a year and a half in the late 90s. And his leading cohorts in the inner circle, or the inner sanctum of power in Russia, are both former, one is a former FSB chief after Putin, Nikolai Petrushev, and the other is the current longtime FSB director, Alexander Botnikov. And Putin has known these people and trusts them. He's known them for decades. But I think you use the word deliberate, and it certainly would appear that these attacks on civilian targets, both apartment buildings, clinics, hospitals, maternity wards, shelters, are deliberate. A nuclear reactor, I might add, the first week of the war, I think those are deliberate, and they're designed to create fear and terror. And Putin is at very high risk of being investigated, and not only Putin, but the leadership surrounding him, Petrushev, Shoigu, Defense Minister Shoigu, FSB Director Bortnikov, SVR Director Sergei Naryshkin, are all potentially at risk down the road. These investigations can take years of being indicted for war crimes under a doctrine that goes back to General Yamashita in World War II, and the end of World War II in Japan, of command responsibility. And these doctrines were used in the Hague War Crimes Tribunal of leaders such as Radovan Karadzic and General Ratko Mladic to build a legal case against them. So Putin and his leadership have to be very cautious looking forward because of what they already likely bear responsibility for in the Ukraine. But I do think it's designed to create terror and fear and to weaken the resolve of the Ukrainian leadership and their population, because the Russian military invasion on the ground has run into many logistical problems. It's stalled. There are over 12,000 deaths. This was actually reported on Russian state TV this past week. So there have been a lot of military unexpected failures on the part of Russia's previously vaunted military.
Many people like to refer to that famous Russian Security Council meeting before the invasion, where Putin was sitting far from his advisors, and how his advisors looked terrified. So some say it just shows how isolated Putin is from his inner circles, probably more so during the COVID. How would that affect his mental status and his decision-making process?
There are several ways that the isolation, which I agree with, that he's more isolated, could affect his decision-making calculus. But I want to point out that Putin's isolation is not new either. Around 2012 or 2013, the renowned German journalist and filmmaker Hubert Seipel made a documentary that's available on YouTube for free. You can Google it, and I think it has English subtitles, called I Putin. And he spent many months with Putin in his inner circle. He had really remarkable access to President Putin at that time, traveled with him, mingled with him. And even Seipel spoke of Putin's isolation even at that time. I think you're correct that it's worsened because of COVID. And it's also, there are other variables. During President Putin's first two terms, his leadership included a wider diversity of viewpoints. And he had really brilliant people that helped him lead and manage the economy, like a former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, and several brilliant prime ministers, aside from Medvedev. I think now it's much more of a tighter inner circle. That also goes along with, because Putin is older, he's now almost 70, 69, you see sometimes in aging leaders, especially aging authoritarian leaders, a greater tendency toward what psychologists call cognitive rigidity and a lack of integrative flexibility and complexity. Translation, the world is much more black and white, and they lose the ability to see shades of gray or nuance that can lead them to make better decisions.
As you mentioned earlier, Russian and Ukrainian military forces are asymmetric, and yet Russian troops have suffered heavy losses in Kyiv as they met surprisingly strong resistance from Ukrainian soldiers and untrained civilians. It seems Russian soldiers have a low morale as they don't have a good cause to fight for. So is Putin able to see the reality and reassess his decision?
I think so. Putin is already, I think, tragically, the bombing is one reassessment and recalibration, because the Russian military has not been able to take a single major city. They've now resorted to these basically medieval siege tactics to try and weaken the will of the Ukrainian leadership and the Ukrainian people. What Putin really missed, though, is two other things. Prior to this invasion, the Russians, under doctrines from General Valery Gerasimov, have really been brilliant at what analysts call hybrid warfare or asymmetric warfare, gray zone warfare, where you have a combination of tactics, including not only military, but political, disinformation, cyber, economic tactics. And surprisingly, none of those are working very well for Russia. And I think that caught even our analysts in the West by surprise. And I suspect for your listeners, I bet it caught the Chinese leadership and the PLA by surprise, because the Russians have been very good at it, hacking into elections, all sorts of mischief, if you will, in addition to aggressive behavior. Where they went wrong this time was on several domains. The planning and the command and control appears to have been weak. I'm not a military expert, but a lot of military experts in the media have commented on that. The other is, while Putin controls much of the information space in Russia, he doesn't control all of it there. There are many Russians in the Russian middle class, the upper classes, the elites, the oligarchs. They all have, many of them travel extensively. Many have relatives in the West, so they can pick up a phone and find out what's going on, even if the internet is blocked. And this has also been commented on recently in the media. There are hundreds of thousands of Russian citizens, mostly middle class and upper middle class and oligarchs, living in Western Europe, for example. So they know what's going on. And the other thing I might add is Putin doesn't control the information space in the Ukraine. And President Zelensky has been brilliant in his use of Twitter and social media to rally his people and to rally the West. And I think he's been the X factor in all of this, where Vladimir Putin completely misread Zelensky's courage, heroism, and really his kind of epiphany type of moment where he said, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition. He's willing to die for his country. And I don't think they expected that.
Right now, Russian troops are stalled as they head toward Kyiv. They appear to be suffering from shortage of food and fuel. Are you concerned that a corner Putin is more dangerous? Do you think there's a possibility he's not afraid to push the nuclear button?
That's been a risk that I agree with you, that a cornered dangerous Putin is a more dangerous Putin. And Putin is a very resilient person. He's undergone many, many hardships in his life from childhood onward, and has shown the ability to bounce back. That's kind of the hallmark of resilience. So underestimating Putin, let alone a cornered Putin, is a fool's errand, I think. He writes a story in his autobiography published in English in 2000 called First Person, in Russian, Первое лицо, where he talks about growing up in these tenements in the 50s after the war. Most Russians in the big cities lived in these tenements that were called kommunalki, and they had poor lighting, poor electricity, so he saw a rat once, and he couldn't get past the rat, so he ended up, the rat was cornering him, and he beat the rat and then ran away. So a cornered Putin psychologically is a very risky, dangerous Putin. Would he, in such a state, if he felt that his own power and his own country's standing was under existential threat, would he use a nuclear weapon or a chemical weapon? I fear to say he might. So I think analysts and people in the media have to be very careful in the language they choose. You don't want to put Putin in a corner. He is the leader of the largest country in the world geographically, and he has 6,000 nuclear weapons. So he's like a hostage taker with nuclear weapons. And as I've said before, sometimes it's better to let the bear run out of the cage back into the woods.
Then what kind of off-ramp the West could offer that Putin would deem acceptable without satisfying all of his demands?
That's a good question. And it's not a popular question because it's not very satisfying to think of offering a leader an off-ramp or a diplomatic negotiation when the leader has done the kind of things that Putin has allegedly ordered in this, what he calls a special military operation, including possible war crimes. So that thought is very unpalatable. It doesn't feel very satisfying to citizens around the world, given the horror that they witness every night on their TV or on their cell phone and social media. That being said, I think the first thing they need is a ceasefire. Second, once they have a ceasefire, then they can figure out if the Ukrainians, and Zelensky has offered hints of some of this. This is all negotiable. This is what diplomats do. And offer, for example, a moratorium on joining NATO or some type of autonomy for Russian speakers in the Donbas. Even Crimea could be negotiated potentially. I don't see Zelensky wanting to give Crimea away, but in diplomatic negotiation, could he sign a 100-year lease, a 99-year lease? Of course, this has happened many other times. So in other countries. So I think this is the hard work of diplomacy that will begin, the hard and necessary work of diplomacy that will begin once we have a ceasefire. Both the Europeans and the Americans are fortunate that they have highly expert diplomats who have met with Putin before, negotiated with Putin, including the CIA director, former ambassador to Russia, Bill Burns. These are people who are used to these type of difficult negotiations. They spent decades in it. And I might add, the other thing that I think would help with an off-ramp, to use that word, would be the use of a third-party mediator. We've already seen hints of this, but I don't think the mediator will be someone from Europe. I think it's more likely that it would be someone that all parties trust, that has the stature and that Putin also trusts. So a high-level mediator from China, such as Yang Jiechi or Wang Yi, someone at that level, or from Israel, Prime Minister Bennett, or from India, the Foreign Minister Jaishankar, who served as ambassador both in China and in the United States and has served as a diplomat in Russia. Someone of that stature and intelligence who can do difficult negotiations and help mediate. This is a model that worked at the end of the Kosovo, the 87-day Kosovo War in 1999, where the role of an outside mediator, the former Finnish Prime Minister and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Martti Ahtisaari, was really instrumental in stopping the war. And notice, when the war stopped, Milosevic was still in power, but his power was changed forever because of the actions that he and his military carried out in, not only in Bosnia, but in Kosovo.
You mentioned China. Chinese President Xi Jinping told Biden over a video call that Ukraine is the U.S. problem. What can the world offer to Xi for him to shift his approach to the war?
President Xi knows better than that. It's the Ukraine is also China's is potentially part of the solution. China's the Ukraine's largest trading partner, and the Ukraine is part of President Xi's famed Belt and Road Initiative. So I think the Chinese are. There's a lot of mixed messaging from the highest levels of the Chinese government, which is very interesting. But being a bit of an optimist, I think the trends to look at aren't where the Chinese are playing the blame game and saying, well, the U.S. started this because of NATO and all that. But rather, the remarks made by Foreign Minister Wang Yi fairly consistently over the last several weeks about the role of sovereignty and, quote, Ukraine is no different. The remarks made by Hu Wei, who published a long article this past week, a think tank, by the way, affiliated with the Chinese government, a leading scholar, really talking about the equities that China has and why they should jettison Putin. And I think that's the tricky part that President Xi and his leadership have to do. They have to figure out a way to jettison Putin without jettisoning the relationship with Russia, which is a valued strategic relationship for them. And they share a long history and a 5,000-mile border. It's in China's interest to get along well with Russia, but they have equities in Europe and the West. They have to be able to trade with Europe. They have to rebuild the relationship with the United States. And I don't see President Xi or China wanting to be linked with a pariah or with a state that's a pariah state.
And finally, how would Putin's invasion of Ukraine embolden Xi Jinping's ambition to use military forces on Taiwan?
I'm not sure it's emboldened it. I think the opposite. I think Putin's invasion of the Ukraine and the setbacks that he's achieved, while the Chinese are watching, so are the Taiwanese and their people and their leadership. So I think it's probably given him and his leadership and military planners pause because of it's a high degree of risk involved. And President Xi, based on my studies of him, is very calculating and careful. And he's not a disruptor the way we've seen Putin all along. He wants to work within a rules-based order. He just wants more control in the order and wants China to have more seats in the table in the organizations and institutions of that order. So I think he will be much more cautious and careful in this regard, and relying more on a longer-term patience strategy to co-opt Taiwan rather than attempt a military invasion, because the same thing that happened in terms of rallying our allies could certainly happen with our Asian allies. So I think that would be a risky move that I don't see him taking. The other thing that everyone knows and your listeners know is President Xi values stability, and especially in the lead up to October 2022 and what appears to be a likely third term, third five-year term for him. The last thing he wants to do is either take political actions that would lead to further instability or take actions that would be more disruptive in that regard. And what we've seen lately with Xi is again, a bit of hedging. And the Chinese are trying to do what's really impossible. They're trying to untie a Gordian knot, where they don't criticize Putin and Russia explicitly, but they can sort of, quote, do the right thing and show themselves to be a responsible superpower. I think it's very hard to do, but they're certainly trying it. The other thing I think is that these critiques of Russia that have come out, like Hu Wei's essay this week, that was published internally among the CCP and the leadership for a week. It wasn't taken down online. And so anything like that that gets said, or comments by Wang Yi, or, oh my gosh, the comment of the Chinese ambassador to the Ukraine, we stand with the people of the Ukraine. If President Xi didn't agree with that, they would have removed that ambassador, called him back for consultations, and said he was speaking for himself, not for the views of the People's Republic of China. So that didn't happen. That's a strong message to Putin, the Russians, and the West, that China is going to, I think, tilt and put itself in a valuable position rather than link with a pariah state. As your listeners also know, Professor Kerry Brown, a former British diplomat who's written about Xi, has often referred to Xi as CEO of China Incorporated, and kind of the way he runs things. And I recommend his writings highly. If you look at that model of it and step away from the emotion, being associated with war crimes or a potential war criminal is bad for China's brand. It's bad for business.
非常感谢乔治·布什美中关系基金会高级研究员、政治心理学家肯尼斯·德克瓦莱的分析和点评。来宾发表的都是个人意见，并不一定代表美国之音。